Hello, I'm Mark Gerson, and I'm the rabbi's husband. And on this show, I hope to demonstrate just how accessible, exhilarating, and simply helpful the Torah is to everybody in our daily lives, whoever we are, whatever we do. In my capacity as a rabbi's husband, I sometimes get asked for romantic advice based on Judaism. I go through two Torah passages, both from Genesis, and then I give the most practical advice: marry a rabbi. I am grateful every day, both to be married to a rabbi and to be married to the specific rabbi, and that's Erica. Being married to a rabbi means that the home is a place where the Torah is studied, discussed, and hopefully lived on a daily basis. And it is my joy as the rabbi's husband to bring that gift to you. This week, I am bringing back a refreshed version of a great conversation I had several months back with Senator Cory Booker about one of the awesome passages in the Bible, Genesis 18:1, about how we can identify and discover the angels in our lives. I am delighted to be joined today by Senator Cory Booker, a Stanford All-American tight end, Rhodes Scholar, and Yale Law School graduate. Senator Booker is a two-term mayor of Newark, New Jersey, where he led the revival of New Jersey's largest city. He is now in his second term in the United States Senate. Cory, who is a Christian, has spent an adult lifetime studying and drawing inspiration from Jewish texts. I know this firsthand, as in the course of my 25-year friendship with Cory has, among other things, we've enjoyed dozens of Shabbat dinners. He brought me to the Rebbe's grave in Crown Heights several times. He crashed my Jewish wedding. We were otherwise planning on eloping. He has attended Seders at our home for 20 consecutive years and was the tzaddik at our eldest son's bris. So, Cory, welcome to the rabbi's husband.
I love it. I have to say, I feel like the rabbi who gets a little short shrift. Has she made an appearance, a guest appearance on the podcast at all?
No, maybe she should be the 100th guest. So, Cory, of all that you've studied in Judaism, of all that you've lived in Judaism, explain to us why you chose Genesis 18, 1 through 10 as the passage to discuss, both what it means to you and actually what happens in the passage.
Well, it is one of the stories, seminal stories. First of all, it's hard to choose for me. And I think one of the reasons why I've taken such delight in doing many years of what the Torah portion for each week is that there are so many rich stories that I've drawn on in my public speeches. My whole presidential campaign, one of the seminal stories I would tell would be about the Torah portion written where King was killed. And, you know, behold, here cometh the dreamer, let us slay him and see what becomes of his dream. This idea of rising from the pit, leading a nation through crisis is what Joseph was able to do. So there's lots of stories like that that have so formed and shaped a lot of my speeches and a lot of my inspiration. But there's something about this story because it involves sort of two of the great legs of, I think, two of the great values of humanity. One is chesed, kindness, and the other is tzedakah, which a lot of people think is charity, but it's really justice.
Right.
And it is a story that encompasses those two legs, pillars to humanity, all evidenced in the man who was going to be the father of many nations. And it starts with Abraham sitting in pain, having just circumcised himself. And I love doing this to, you know, Jewish student groups when they come down and see me in the Senate and asking them, you know, when did he receive the blessing? And many people say, well, it was after the circumcision. I'm going, no, a lot happened between the circumcision and the blessing. And so he's sitting in pain, and Abraham sees strangers in the desert. And I remember one rabbi was telling me that the Torah specifically talks about them being different, that some of the commentary says that they were different, like different race even than him. But it says that he gets up, and the Torah doesn't say he welcomes him. It says he ran to them.
Exactly.
Ran to them. To welcome that enthusiasm of seeing strangers.
And even before that, it says God approached him, and then he looks up, sees him, and runs to him. So he interrupts his presumed conversation with God to run to the stranger.
Yes, which is so powerful. And then he just welcomes them into his tent. And I love these ideals in Judaism, welcome the stranger because you were once a stranger in the strange land. In fact, I tell people one of my favorite moments as an American was the night in January of the first incarnation of the Muslim ban. It was just so obviously written in a way. It was ultimately challenged in court, won, and was changed a few times before they found something that was could pass judicial muster. But I go out to Dulles Airport. Matt Clapper, our mutual friend, was out there and said, you've got to get out here. So I rush out to Dulles Airport to help. I had a court order to let Customs Border Patrol know that they had to give people access to a counsel, the lawyers that were being detained. But I get there and I'm blown away. The concourse is full of Americans cheering when Muslim families would come out. And what I saw, being someone who spent a lot of time with Orthodox Jews, is I saw this group of Orthodox Jews, kippahs, beards, tzitzas, dancing as if they were at a Jewish wedding, celebrating and welcoming Muslim families from other countries coming into America. And I got such chills watching these men dance and sing and celebrate the welcoming of strangers coming into America from a different faith and race. It was amazing to me.
Beautiful.
So this to me is this fundamental first pillar, is that chesed, that kindness, that decency, and how we should act towards the other, which for those of us who've been different, Jewish, Black, you're often the other in our own country, and seeing that kind of grace and that kind of decency.
When you mentioned that Abraham ran to the strangers, they weren't going anywhere.
Right.
So he runs, and then as the passage proceeds, he tells them, I'll fetch you a morsel of bread. Turns out he and Sarah and their lad were making a feast, but he calls it a morsel of bread. And then the word haste appears 5 times in the passage in the consideration of how quickly they made the food and how quickly they delivered it to him, leading to the great Jewish teaching deriving from this, that the deeds of the righteous are done in haste.
But first, just can you go back and highlight that idea of humility, you know, this morsel. They didn't lord his wealth over them. You know, when I was mayor, one of our sort of guiding principles was to under-promise, over-deliver.
That's a great leadership principle of the Bible. I hadn't thought of that. That's exactly what he does.
Yes.
He's going to bring you a morsel. He brings him a feast.
Right, right. Really powerful. And then I love that you picked up on this idea that you are hustling. You're moving quickly to doing righteous action. And I really believe that, you know, Maimonides, what is it, 8 levels of giving, this idea of giving when you are not asked is a higher level.
So it was 33 days before the Iowa caucus, and I got a call from you. And you said to me, I know how deeply involved you are supporting Christian missionary doctors working in Africa. I want to make a donation to serve that cause. And this was you. Nobody asked you. I never would have thought to even think that you were thinking about the stranger, the poor in Africa who are so tragically and unforgivably ignored. But that's who you were thinking about 33 days before Iowa. So talk about giving without being asked. That to me epitomized it. And nobody even knows it. No one knows it. You know, people think politicians do things for the press, whatever. No one until now knows that you did that.
Right. I often think that what we see or say about other people is more a reflection of who we are than who they are. And so whether you're saying negative or positive things, it's a reflection of who you are. And
that's right.
I know a touch of what you do and your work in Africa. When you were telling me about the shortage of doctors, and you, a devout Jew, was supporting Christian missionaries, a Christian organization, I was so flattened by that. It affected me in a way that
thank you.
Never lost. But also the fact that I just didn't know. I didn't know of the level of need, how few doctors per people in large areas of the continent of Africa.
Yeah, very often it's one doctor for every 30 to 40,000 people.
Yeah.
That's a problem that Christian missionary doctors alleviate. And that's a problem that you helped alleviate when you called me 33 days before Iowa to ask how you could give. I mean, this is what you were thinking about 33 days before Iowa. You were thinking about the stranger, the poor, how you could help and how you did help. And no one knew about it. Let's talk about another example that you did. So Abraham, as we've talked about, ran to the guests, and then he and his wife and their lad were in haste 5 times. You were in a similar circumstance when you in Newark saw a house burning, literally burning next to you. And you literally ran. You literally ran. I mean, there was no time to do it. There was no time to think, to consider. You had to act or not act. You couldn't walk. You either had to stand and watch or run. And you ran into a burning house.
Yeah. The family was coming out and the mother kept yelling that her daughter was still in the home, and ascended to the top of the stairs as sort of this, some kind of electricity exploded before us. And my security guard and I began to have a bit of a fight.
He did not want you to go and you wanted to go.
Yeah.
And the Stanford tight end and you came back out and you rushed into the house.
He and I were at the top of the stairs. Both of us were in the house. So he had bravery as well. But when the thing exploded, that's when he said, we can't get this person out. So fire had engulfed the kitchen, was rolling across I'll never forget. It looked like liquid rolling across the ceiling of the kitchen. The kitchen was being engulfed. So then he grabs me by the belt to try to drag me out. I just instinctively, as most people would, just said, if we don't try, they're going to die. And at that point, I darted through the kitchen. But I still remember that was a powerful personal moment for me, more because it was the first time in my life I felt myself just agree that I was going to die. Like, it was like when I got in there, she was non-responsive. It was pitch black with smoke. I remember as a kid in school, you drop to the floor and I just couldn't breathe there either. It felt like I was breathing in hot ash. Looked back to the kitchen and now it seemed impassable. And I was screaming for the person to respond. Then I started trying to find my own way out of another exit. We were on the second floor. I was just trying to find a window and I couldn't. I was tripping over things, pounding on things. And it was just that I felt myself sort of realize that this was probably it. I heard her say something and then it was all gone. I just really think at that point I shut down. It was like her voice was like a voice of an angel, honestly. I said this to her, that I felt like she saved me, because at that point I was about to give up and I breathed in too much smoke and was just feeling sick. And she said something. So then I darted towards the voice, found her, grabbed her in my arms. And then I realized there was no way out but through that kitchen. And then she, again, like an angel, I kind of felt like she saved and protected me, because the way I was holding her, remember I said the ceiling was it. So there was hot stuff melting off of the ceiling and the fire was there. So she actually protected me. She got really bad burns on her. My hand burned from where I was holding her, sort of the part of me that was really exposed. I don't think that was conscious in the way that Abraham was doing it. I think that was all instinct, all things beyond my power. It got me out of there alive and to this day.
It may or may not have been conscious, but no one tells Abraham to do what he did. No one tells Abraham, hey, why don't you just interrupt God and go to the stranger? But he had internalized what it meant to live the Torah as the Torah was being, before it was revealed. He'd internalized it. It became part of who he was. So he just acted just like you did. When it becomes a part of you, no one has to tell you, because it's you and you just go act accordingly.
I mean, one of the reasons why he's such an extraordinary figure to me is we've already seen God call out to Adam, right? Where are you? And he was hiding. He calls out to Moses, and Moses doesn't want any part of what God's.
That's right.
But Abraham, when God calls him, he says, "Hinei me, behold, God, here I am." He's sort of this figure that stands up and assumes responsibility, and so he's kind of singular in that way. And I think a lot of us are racked with, like Moses was, with insecurities, as Moses was, felt like he couldn't talk. But here's this guy that to me was so powerful in his willingness to do right. And what is interesting here, and I know we haven't gotten to this point, I remember falling in love with the Torah because it brought things out to me that I hadn't really thought about. And this was back when I was in Oxford, when I realized this irrational willingness, as you said, remember, he leaves God. He's God and him are about to have a conversation and he runs away from God to do good, to do justice. And I started putting it together that there are numerous points in the Torah where this idea of not obeying God's will is actually celebrated. Remember when Moses comes down and sees his people worshiping a golden calf, God says, let me destroy these people, give you some more people to lead. And I think the Hebrew is ma'cheni na misifrecha. If you destroy these people, then erase me from your book. I mean, how radical is that? That you're telling a deity, you're telling God that I want no part of you if you do this. And so this idea of defiance as a celebrated virtue, and I know we're jumping ahead so we can jump ahead then rewind, but I said that one thing, chesed, when I think the best example of tzedakah is when the angels have now revealed themselves, they have blessed Abraham. Now they say to Abraham, they tell him what they're going to go do. They're going to go, and for me as a mayor, it's kind of scary. They say they're going to go destroy a city. You know, they're off to go destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And what I would do, messengers from God were telling me what they do, I'd be like, yes, Lord, or whatever. But no, he starts fighting, arguing with angels to not destroy, to show mercy and not destroy a city. And to me, that's where he goes from showing chesed, kindness, this humility, under promise, over deliver, hastily doing goodness and decency. And that was the last act he did before he was blessed. And then the first act he really does after a blessing is to now fight for justice.
To negotiate on behalf of the people of the cities.
And so my point is like those to me are the two legs of humanity when we are at our best. One leg, kindness, decency, charity. The other leg, justice, a just world. No matter if it's a so-called act of God, a hurricane or tsunami or what have you, it's this ideal of I'm going to stand up for what is just, no matter if it's a will of God.
It's a beautiful point, particularly about how the Jewish insistence on arguing with God, on everybody, yes, including God, living under principles. And it's in the Jewish Torah, in the Jewish imagination, it's perfectly acceptable, indeed required, to call everyone to account for not living up to their principles, even God. And if you can do it with God, you can sure do it with anybody. God seems to love it. So when Abraham bolts from his communication with God to serve the stranger, God seems to love it. He seems to think, that's exactly what I want. And I think we get that sense. So these men are really angels, because in Hebrew, the word for angel messenger is the same word, same concept. An angel, someone delivers a message. So in the beginning, it says that Abraham lifts his eyes to the angels. After he serves them, he's above them. So they're above him, then he's above them. But by serving them, by treating the stranger as he does, he's elevated above the angels. Mm. This is God's imagination, that when you serve people, you become greater than the angels. And then God gives him the great blessing about that he'll have children immediately thereafter, as if to say, this is what I want in a person.
Yes.
You mentioned meeting an angel before.
Yeah.
So it struck me that's so appropriate, because this is the passage that teaches us that people and angels are indistinguishable, that there are angels all over everywhere. And the angel is not somebody with white wings or something that's up in heaven, but the angels are literally all over. The angel could be the person who taps you on the shoulder and says, don't cross the street right now, then the car goes by. Or it could be the teacher who says to you, I think you'd be a great scientist. It's just the person who just delivers a message from God and then immediately goes back to being a person.
Yes.
And all we have to do is open ourselves up to these people, because God puts them everywhere. So where else have you seen angels?
I have this whole definition of faith that when you come to the end of all the light you know, and you're about to step into the darkness, faith is knowing one of two things that's going to happen. Either you're going to find solid ground underneath you, or the world will teach you people, angels, send you people to teach you how to fly and give you lift to your dreams. And so, you know, I took an unconventional pathway out of law school and jumped into it. But you, my friend, were angelic to me in the very beginning of my career by, you know, you're the one that told me that I should go see our classmate at Nickel, that ended up being a family that has been one of the more influential families in my life, because he helped basically run my first campaign and give me belief that we could do it. So I have had this blessing of every step of my career, and you were really a major player in my ascendancy in Newark by continuing to bring people into my life that gave my life lift and my path of service. So I really do see, I see God using all of us, or using each other, to help to guide us along. And I feel very blessed, frankly, from that. You know, in Newark, I had lots of people who just came into my life in pretty significant ways that sort of guided me along. Like Frank Hutchins was a beautiful man who I wrote about in my book, who from his life to even the last words he said to me were so shaping to me. He was part of a collection of him and Miss Jones, another tenant leader, who pushed me to run for city council and made me believe I could do it. And then people started coming to help, like yourself. Frank's last words to me on his deathbed were, he had gone blind and I walked in and announced myself, and he said, I see you. Was a one sentence he can get out. Like I said, hey, Frank, it's Corey. He's like, I see you. And then the last thing I said to him was a goodbye and I love you. And then he forced out the words, I love you. And I was just thinking about those words. I see you. I love you. I see you. I love you. And that's when you talk about how the suffering of so many people are invisible to us, whether it's the communities you help serve in Africa, where when we see each other, number one, we acknowledge it. You see the stranger in the distance, to actually see them and then love them, which is to serve them and to be there for them. And so in many ways, Frank's very life and the way he lived, and he led the longest rent strike in Newark history after the abysmal conditions of the Newark Housing Authority, and spent his whole life in service of others. That value in acknowledging everyone. And I see the way you in your life, Mark, treat people who others might relegate to a lower, quote unquote, station in life. But the ability to truly see the character and the grace and the divinity in everyone, and then to be active, and love is an action verb and not a passive one. Love involves sacrifice. You can't love your kids without it's a struggle. It is a service. It is sacrifice. It's hard. And so those ideals I've had incredible teachers that have appeared in my life that have helped me to try to be a better servant of God's will, what I believe is God's will.
What a way to live. If we actually looked at everybody around us, like Abraham did, as a potential messenger of God, how different our daily lives would be and how much different our world would be. And I think what Abraham's teaching us here is, and you live it, is that's not a fantasy. That's the real world. Everybody can be a messenger from God, and God sends messengers to do all kinds of things all the time. We just have to pay attention.
I remember a moment where, you know, I'm often driven by a great guy named Kevin Batts, who's been in my life for a long time. And I was coming home from a long day's work, and we were three blocks from where I'm sitting now in Newark. There's a McDonald's. The flesh is weak. And he looks at me in the rearview mirror, and I just put my head down. And next thing you know, we're turning in. I'm a plant-based guy. So all I want is to get like two large French fries. We go through the drive-thru. I get my large French fries. So I'm holding my McDonald's French fries, and we're about to drive out. And I see a guy in a dumpster at the end of the drive-thru. So I know what I have to do. So I roll down my window. I call out to him. He sort of tries to brush me off. And I realize I don't want to assault his dignity. So I asked it in a lighthearted way. You know, I said, hey, man, you need anything? And he's like, I'm hungry. And so I pulled out my McDonald's French fries and I hand it to him. And I think the interaction's over. I've given him half of my bounty. And he seemed very happy. And then he says to me, do I have any socks? Now, you've worked with homeless people. I've worked with homeless people. It's like, this is something that's probably worth its weight in gold. He probably had something going on with his feet. And I look mainly around my car. I don't carry extra socks. And I'm like, sorry, sir, I don't have any socks. And then I look forward in my car thinking that Kevin's going to drive away. But Kevin doesn't drive away. He puts the car in park, reaches between his legs, takes off the shoes he's wearing, pulls off the socks he's wearing, and hands them to the guy who's thrilled that he has socks. Now, I'm three blocks from my home. I have socks upstairs that I haven't opened yet from, I think my mom gave me, you know, some Christmas long ago. But I didn't think in that moment to do like Abraham did, his example. And it was such a great lesson. It was like a lightning bolt to me.
Well, I think that man was an angel, right? Because you're thinking about it and talking about it now, because that man educated you.
Yes, he really did. And
what a gift. He's an angel. Thank you for being on The Rabbi's Husband and for 25 years now. Next month will be our 25th anniversary of friendship.
Well, Bizrat Hashem, we can celebrate in person sometime soon for a quarter century of you being stuck with me.
It's been a blessing in every respect. And God willing, we'll get together in person soon and we'll have another Pesach together.
Well, what a terrific discussion as ever with Senator Cory Booker about what might be, perhaps counterintuitively, the most important and practical and actionable experience of our lives, which is identifying and properly interacting with the angels who are all around us all the time. So thank you, Cory, for bringing the truth of Genesis 18 to all of our lives. Next year in Graceland. I'm Mark Gerson, and this has been The Rabbi's Husband, and thank you for listening. Please go to Apple, to Spotify, to wherever you receive podcasts, rate, review, and subscribe. I can be found at therabbishusband.com or at The Rabbi's Husband on Facebook or Instagram, and I would love to hear from you, so please email me at mark@therabbishusband.com. This podcast is part of the Joshua Network. You can find out more about the Joshua Network at thejoshuanetwork.com. Thank you for listening.